you're a little bit more skeptical of tax credits and of this program. Kind of just generally, what is your kind of take on this program in general?
I think it's a program that's meant to deal with a real issue, which is the availability of low-income housing. But I think the program itself is very flawed. I think that not enough of the money gets into projects. Not to get so much in the weeds, but spreading this thing out over a 10-year period versus maybe a 5-year period, I think you'd have more money go into projects. With respect to the fight that we're having trying to reduce the amount of money the state expends in this area, we've heard from lots of developers. The developers are okay with what we're trying to do. It's really the syndicators that have a problem with us lowering the caps on low-income housing. Mm-hmm.
So the syndicators, the people that buy up the tax credit.
They don't just buy them. They buy them and they sell them and they organize. They organize the investor groups. Quite frankly, it's they that want the caps to be as right now the caps in that are defined by the federal grant. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones that really want that to be as high as it possibly can be. Look, I think there were 90 projects put forward in front of this commission, of which 30 or something were approved. And then the fact that there are 90 projects that are trying to get this credit speaks to the financial advantage this credit brings to these projects. So it's very profitable venture to go into. It's because of the existence of this state-specific funding source.
Now, kind of the way the program is structured, I mean, it is kind of fashioned toward getting syndicators or banks or people who buy tax credits involved, because I guess that's the way that they spit out equity to a developer, by buying and selling those. From what I was talking with the executive director of Beyond Housing, he mentioned that, when he's trying to do a project in Pine Lawn, he gets maybe, I'm just throwing out a number here, $6 million in tax credits. He'll only get like $2.6 million back, because I guess they're valued pretty low. Is that kind of
not to get in the way. It's a time value of money. So it's the nature of the credit such that, there's a certain amount. You have to the end investor has to hold on to the project, and their ability to redeem or to sell off these credits are 1 year at a time. And they can sell. They can sell the stream itself. But it's kind of like this. If I told you I was going to give you $1,000 10 years from now, well, then you wouldn't give me $1,000 today for that promise. And so it's just the time value of money that this developer is speaking towards. That's not going to go away. I don't have an issue with that. I have an issue with the spread between what the project's receiving and what the investors are receiving, and that's where the problem lies. And so we're not trying to eliminate the program. If we get the caps, these are caps that the second tax credit commission agreed to, it's not going to go away. It's still going to be very lucrative. There'll still be lots of projects. It's just trying to keep it the cost of it as low as possible.
So what would you want to do with the program? How low would you want to bring the cap, and what other changes would you make to the program?
I would be fine in the spirit of compromise. I would just assume have us rely on the federal tax credit program, like most other states do.
So you would get rid of the state program altogether?
I would. Or the one caveat might be, and this would be the way I would do historics too, a lot of states, the way they do these credit programs is they kind of do a one-time program. So, and that happens a lot in historics. So like Virginia, for example. State of Virginia, a few years ago, they approved $75 million for historic tax credits, a one-time issuance of historic tax credits. Mm-hmm. Ideas are put forward, the General Assembly and the appropriators decide, we've got the resources, this is a good project, we go ahead and issue the credits. Mm-hmm. Something like that. I mean, again, I think there's a dozen states that have state-specific LIHTC programs. I would just as soon be one of the other states. That's not an option politically, and so spirit of compromise. A lot of work went into both the first and the second tax credit commission. And to the proposal I'd like to see go forward is just to take up the recommended caps in those proposals.
I believe, is that $110 million or is that lower?
That's what it is, yeah.
So, okay, I seem to recall last year that there was like a last-minute tax credit deal, and I think it was like $90 million for historics and $110 million for historics.
So let's speak to that. So what I'm suggesting is that this program is less than efficient. but in the spirit of compromise, I'll go with the commission caps.
Right.
The House specifically, and then a certain percentage of our senators, they too are willing to go to the commission caps, which in my mind speaks to the idea that if the program were perfect and didn't need to be rolled back, that then you would never agree to capping it because it would be a perfect program. Mm. They're acknowledging the fact that it's less than perfect, and they're willing to cap them at the commission rates. But they're only willing to do that in exchange for the creation of a series of brand new programs, which, quite frankly, when you actually look at them one by one, they will cost the state, you know, every bit as much. They're every bit as much inefficient as, in my opinion, than the LIHTC tax credits are. And quite frankly, when I actually take the time to go through the new programs and understand them, I understand them as well, if not better, than the sponsors themselves. Mm-hmm. So the House is willing to say, look, we'll acknowledge the fact that low-income housing and historic should be capped. We're willing to cap them, but only in exchange for the creation of a series of new programs. To me, that's horse trading. That's not making good policy.
And I guess one of the other things, this is kind of an aside, they want to renew the land assemblage program. Is that going to run into trouble in the Senate? I know that's been controversial over the years.
Yeah, well, that's in the list of programs that I consider to be less than efficient. Angel tax credits, freight forwarding tax credits, land assemblage tax credits. I'm sure I'm missing, you know, two or three others.
Yeah.
But all individual pet projects targeted a very narrow group of end users. No, that's you know, what we're trying to do, a handful of us in the Senate, is to say, look, this program is way too big. We think it's very inefficient. In the spirit of compromise, we'll meet at the commission caps. That's where we are.
That might be the soundbite for the story, by the way. So I want to just play devil's advocate of what some of these people who have used this have said. They said if you lower the caps, I mean, just by basic math, there's going to be less money for units. The amount of affordable housing units is going to go down every year. And there's still going to be a need for affordable housing, but not as many resources to build it. I know you've probably heard that argument before, but how do you respond to that type of argumentation?
Well, this concept of, I mean, define need, show me the analysis that have been done, show me what the expectation of need would be on a 5 and 10 year basis. Because the question I would ask is, how could it be that Missouri has been spending hundreds of millions of dollars for going on 15 years to fill this low-income housing need? Is it an endless low-income housing need the state has? I mean, show me the analysis that says that is in fact. And the question I would have is, you know, how do the 35-plus other states, how do they meet their low-income housing need? Why would their low-income housing need be any greater than ours? I mean, again, not per capita, not by any other metric are we the second largest program in the country. It's by total dollars. You know, and I think it's us in California and Georgia that are right around the same place. Well, California's a little bit different place than the fact that we're head-to-head with them in total dollars allocated to low-income housing. It suggests to me that the idea that we have this dramatic need for low-income housing that other states don't have is unfounded.
Then my other question is, and we had Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder on our podcast a few weeks ago, and obviously he's involved in this because he sits on MHDC. And when I asked him about the question of influence, because one of the things that has been people have criticized about this program is, as you mentioned, syndicators and developers, you know, want to keep this the same. They have a vested interest. He argued that, you know, yes, they're involved, but there are other interest groups that are far more involved in giving people money and far more involved in, you know, the political process, like trial attorneys and labor. I'm sure you've heard that argument too, but what's your response to that sort of thing?
Well, if someone was suggesting to me that that what it was that I was supporting, my support was coming from the influence of a select few, or if what is I'm advocating for only benefits a select few, I don't think the argument that I would make in support of my going along with this idea would be that, well, in comparison to other special interests, it's a better my I've got some moral high ground or something. I don't know. I mean, just because other people are being unduly influenced in other matters, that doesn't seem like the argument that I would make if I was trying to defend my position in support of LIHTC.
Do you think that the syndicated developers do have an inordinate influence? I mean, I remember last year Senator Lager basically said the House was corrupt because developers and banks and whatnot were unduly influencing them. Do you share that view, or do you think that might be tad overreacting in many respects?
No, what I would say, and this is maybe where I would echo the sentiments of Lieutenant Governor, is that a long list of special interests control a select few of the General Assembly in such a way that they're able to keep laws from coming to be. So one of the things I least appreciated before I came down here is how hard it is to pass a law. One thing I've now come to appreciate is how easy it is to stop a law. So the problem that reformers like I have with LIHTC is we need to change a law, and it only takes but a handful of people to keep a law from changing.
A couple more questions. I mean, we actually had Treasurer's Weifel on our podcast too, who's also involved, and I think he's probably more amenable to changing low-income housing. I mean, he was one of the people that voted to delay all those. But he mentioned that this issue has just kind of been on a treadmill for the past few years, and nothing's gotten done, and it's just basically been a circular argument between the House and the Senate. And I've heard other people echo that argument, too, and I think reality kind of bears that fruit. Is this going to be just an issue that's going to be endlessly debated, you know, long after you're out of the General Assembly, or do you think there will be finality on this issue this year or the next year?
Well, I have not given up hope that we will solve this. The request of us reformers, and quite frankly, the governor is very involved in this too.
Yeah.
The Boeing deal that we cut was not a hard sell with the governor's office. The governor wants to do this as well. Our ask is to say, let's cap these programs. They need to be capped, and then all of the new ideas, all of the new programs, let them withstand the light of day. Let them come to pass or not pass on their own merit. What I heard consistently, what I do have heard consistently in the previous three sessions, is that bills have been put forward that, as the House would say, reallocate cap space, take cap space from historic and low-income housing, reallocate it to new ideas. And how that's marketed to both insiders as well as the public is just that. We've just reformed tax credits. We've just reallocated cap space. And that's what is discussed. What's not discussed is, well, what exactly is an angel tax credit? Who exactly does get it's investors that get the tax credit, not the companies themselves. Startup companies don't create jobs. It's the second and third, you know. So there's never any scrutiny on the individual programs. And I think a lot of these programs don't want to be scrutinized one at a time. They want to be part of some comprehensive reform bill. The Senate passed out a payday loan reform bill last week, which all of the conservatives voted against. There are five Republicans that voted no. That was a bill that wants to market itself as reform. It's not reform. The three previous sessions where one of the two bodies tried to pass a reform bill was not reform. It was a way to keep scrutiny from individual programs by putting caps on historic and low-income housing.
This is my last question because I know you got to run, but you know, and it's kind of a more esoteric, but I think it's an important question. It seems like a lot of these tax credits, the way they work, as I kind of mentioned, is, you know, somebody gets them and then they sell it to an investor. It seems like that's pretty much the way it works because there's no real person that has, you know, $6 million of state tax liability, but there are banks who have a lot of tax liability in their companies. It's as long as the way any of those tax credits are structured, and as long as there are going to be entities that make money off of that, and, you know, compounded by the fact they're also doing it in other states, is there just going to always be that opposition? Because if people are going to take away that lucrative opportunity, they don't want it to happen, essentially, unless you basically restructure tax credits in a different way. Is that a fair assessment?
You make them non-transferable. I mean, let's just put simple numbers on it. So let's say that you have $100 million tax credits that are going to be issued every single year, and they're transferable. So the very first thing that's going to happen is they're going to be sold for not more than 90 cents on the dollar. So immediately the state has lost $10 million. So $10 million, whatever it's going to go, historic, a loan, whatever it's going to go to. And I'm being generous when I say that the sell price is 90 cents on the dollar. But just to keep the math simple. So think about how stupid that is. Mm-hmm. So we allocate $100 million to something we think needs to be promoted, low-income housing, historic, whatever it is. The state's better off just writing a check for $100 million than it is issuing $100 million in tax credits, because we know at the very beginning we're already 10% behind. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned earlier in the interview, the way that the LIHTC credits are structured, they're sold essentially in the future. So it's more like 45 cents on the dollar that actually goes to the project. So no, it's an unfortunate thing. These things all came to be in periods of time when state governments were flush with cash. There was nothing but good times to be had. No one was worrying about where they have to save 10 or 20 or $50 million. They were more interested in where they're going to allocate the next $100 million. That's where they all started. And we've created a very narrow focused group of people who benefit tremendously by this. When I talk about political donors, there's philosophical donors. I'm a philosophical donor. Somebody speaks to my views, I donate to their campaign. Then there are investors. And we've created a significant political investor class. And if it's 100,000 or a million or 10 million, I can guarantee the return is 10 or 20 fold. Yeah. And that's what we have, and that's what we're up against.
As you mentioned, it's aside. It seems like if you just wrote a check for $10 million to build a LIHTC project, it would seem a lot less complicated. And you wouldn't go through a bank, and the banks wouldn't make money, or a syndicator, or a company or a person that set up a syndication. And it would probably just be more direct in that case. But it seems like the way it is now, it's very complicated, inefficient, and it benefits people that buy these tax credits.
I think your market's the St. Louis market.
Yeah.
Big part of the historic tax credit users, okay? If we did it the way Virginia does it, think about it. Here's what would happen. So you'd have a group that would organize themselves. They would look at all the potential projects in St. Louis City, St. Louis County. They would come together and say, these are $100 million in projects that make tremendous sense. Let's go make our pitch to the General Assembly, explain to them why. General Assembly would decide to say it's a good idea, it's not a good idea. So if the General Assembly says, look, or in this case, like Virginia did a few years ago, here's $75 million. Go spend $75 million on projects. Mm. The way it works now is those projects come down to the Capitol to get authorized the tax credit. Essentially, it's a entitlement. They can actually just fill in the forms. They get the credit. Mm. They turn around. They sell the credit for, in most cases, less than 90 cents on the dollar. So right from the very beginning, they're starting with 10 or 15% less capital than they would have otherwise if they had just come to the General Assembly and gotten the money directly allocated to them.
Yeah.